Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, journalist Todd Brewster discusses his book Seen and Unseen, Technology, Social Media, and the Fight for Racial Justice, which he co-authored with Mark Lamont Hill. Brewster is interviewed by author Catherine Adele West. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director at the American Writers Museum. I want to thank you all for being here today at the American Writers Festival and for joining us for this program. This program is presented in conjunction with the AWM's exhibit Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. It highlights writers in the 100 years between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, and uplifts unheard voices to tell stories that are of particular interest and incredible relevance today. Those stories have been influenced in modern times by the power of visual media, as video and images shift the narrative on race and reignite the push towards justice for all generations. In their new book, Seen and Unseen, Mark Lamont Hill and Todd Brewster examine how the ways in which we see the lived experience of racism change, the ways in which we address them. Unfortunately, Mark has had a family emergency and is not able to be here with us today, but his co-author and their interviewer are here to talk about the book with you. Todd Brewster is a veteran journalist and historian who has worked as an editor for Time and Life and as a senior producer for ABC News. He's the co-author with Peter Jennings of the number one New York Times best-selling book, The Century, which spent nearly a year on the bestseller list, and the author of the acclaimed Lincoln's Gamble. He's here to talk with Catherine Adel West, novelist and editor whose work is published in Black Fox Literary Magazine and many other publications. Catherine was named one of USA Today's Black Authors You Should Know, and The Two Lives of Sarah is her sophomore novel. I'd like to welcome both of them to the stage.
Yeah, that's what I like to hear. As the lovely Miss Allison told you, I'm Catherine Adel West. And we have the wonderful Mr. Todd Brewster, and we're going to be talking about Seen and Unseen. I have so many questions for you, sir.
I'm ready.
Okay,
ready.
Are you ready? Are you ready, though? Mm-hmm. Okay, so first, my first question was, how did you and Mark get together in regards to this book? Who contacted whom? Where did the idea come from?
So Mark and I are good friends. Happened to share the same literary agent who put us together at one point on when Mark was working on a previous book and called Nobody. And he teaches at Temple in the university now. I used to teach at Temple, and our paths crossed there as well. We enjoy each other's company. We enjoy each other's minds, our insights. We like talking about issues. We like talking about issues of race in particular. And the publisher called us about a year and a half ago, I guess, sort of shortly after the killing of George Floyd, to say, is there something here that you guys would like to write about? And we had been talking about not only George Floyd, but also the many episodes that preceded George Floyd in terms of the public consciousness about police killings of black people. And what was different about this moment? And Mark has always said, you know, he thought after Trayvon Martin, things would change. After Michael Brown, things would change. You know, after Tamir Rice, things would change. And it seemed like every episode, no, things would go back. Like I think we were talking about this in the green room, where you push those dolls down, they bounce back up again. It was sort of like that kind of thing. What was wrong with a society that it didn't respond to what was clearly these shameful moments in American history? And as we did, we realized that George Floyd was different, for one thing. And then we wondered, why was George Floyd different? And as we talked about it, we came up with a clear understanding of not only the reason was why George Floyd, the response to George Floyd was a kind of worldwide outrage, one that drove people to the streets here in Chicago, but across all parts of the country. And we began then to think more deeply about where this had happened in previous times in American history. What role had the video that was so compelling? What role had photography play? What role had film play? What role had still photography play throughout American history in terms of telling the story of America and race? And out of that, we conceived, and those of you who have written books will know this, but it's the concept. I know you know this, Catherine.
Yes,
the concept
sir.
is the big creative project, right? It's what is the concept of the book? What are we doing? And then rest of its execution. Now, it organically changes in the process. It's sort of like being an architect creating a building, right? You say, okay, this is my blueprint. But then as you build it, you go, ah, well, this doesn't quite fit, and that doesn't quite fit, but this makes sense. Let's think about this in a different way. And Mark and I love talking together. We have always done so, ever since I met him 5 or 6 years ago. And out of that came this idea. And it was driven in part by our insights into George Floyd and the history of the role of technology and media in American race relations. And it was driven by our companion, our friendship, our working together. So we were thrilled to do it.
Yeah, I was thrilled to read it. So my next question is, while Seen and Unseen deals with the contemporary engagement of social media and its power to shape the narrative of racism in the country, almost as much as the historical context that you use, how were you able to balance that? It seemed pretty seamless. Like, I'd be reading about George Floyd, then you would take me back to, say, you're talking about Birth of a Nation, but it seemed like really seamless. So how do you balance the contemporary and the history?
Very good question. And we talked a little bit about this in the green room also, the notion of pacing in a book, the notion of content, marrying content up with other content so that the reader can see the resonance from one idea to another idea, right?
Yes, sir.
And what we discovered in looking at the story of George Floyd, why did George Floyd create this outrage that it did? Why did it have the power that it did? And I say it meaning the film. What was it about that moment? And I think there are a number of things. One was Darnella Frazier. Darnella Frazier was the young woman who was walking past this incident and had the courage to stand there and lift up her phone and record it. Now, 30 years ago, when Rodney King was killed, there was a gentleman named Holloway who had just bought himself some fancy video equipment, back when the video equipment was stuff you had to carry on in big boxes, right? Not a little cell phone.
Yeah, like back in the 90s, we all know what happened. We all know it was huge. It was so much.
So the idea now is that we've democratized this media, right? I mean, George Holloway wanted to be a professional cameraman, and that's why he had all this equipment. He happened to have captured a moment that was powerful and important in American history that you could almost say is kind of the germ of the more recent chapter of America's experience with recording violence on black people. But now we all have at our disposal the most sophisticated, more sophisticated equipment than was used to film George Floyd. I'm sorry, to film Rodney King. So that's the first difference, Darnella Frazier. And she was not a professional. She was a bystander. She was not particularly, wasn't an activist. She wasn't somebody who had sought to play this role. History put this role on her. She didn't put this role onto history, you know. So that's the first thing that was important. The second thing was important was that the killing of George Floyd, and this is a tough thing for us all to hear, but the killing of George Floyd was more like a crucifixion than a murder. You know, it was like it was a long, drawn-out murder. It was a suffering video. And not many of us have sat and looked at all 9 minutes. You don't need to look at all 9 minutes, but you need to have an understanding of the difference between the power of a film that shows someone being shot and the power of a film that shows someone in a painful, slow death. As I said, this is hard to hear. But what it really tells us is that two things were at work. The film of George Floyd operated as a film, as a narrative. We watched him die, which was like a crucifixion. Was like like the story of Christ. Christ shouts out for his father. He shouts out for his mother. We watch him die. But it was also like a still photograph. How was it like a still photograph? Because the image doesn't change. It is a man, a white man, with his knee in the neck of a black man, suffocating him. Symbolically, the story of black and white relations in America has often been described as the white man with his knee on the black man's neck. It carried a symbolism, that image, almost like a still image, that was so powerful in American race relations and stirred up, it's sort of in our DNA to understand that as a symbolic representation of a part of American history. So it resonated with our history. It resonated with specifics of our history. The story of lynching in America is one of our darkest moments. Lynchings in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were sports for white supremacists. People would gather as entertainment to watch a black man being lynched, often for a crime he didn't commit, to watch black women being lynched as well. Ida B. Wells, whom we also talked about in The Green Room, one of the great journalists of American history, a black woman who exposed the injustice of those who were being lynched in the late 19th and early 20th centuries for crimes they didn't commit, or crimes that were trumped up, or crimes that involved nothing more than looking the wrong way at a white person, right? These resonances, we live in our own time, but we also live in a time that has been prepared for us, right? It has been prepared by the history that preceded us. And in that sense, the story of George Floyd has cinematic power, it has symbolic power, and it has power that is derived from the DNA of American history, right? You put all those together and you realize that that's one story, but there are many others. We then talk, well, that's the dynamic of George Floyd, what's the dynamic of Ahmaud Arbery? You all know the story of Ahmaud Arbery out jogging in Georgia. Three white men, two of them father, son, a third one a friend, pursue him. They claim that he had been casing out a construction site. A construction site, and they thought he was there for looking for trouble, and they decided to try to confront him, and in the end, they do. They follow him in a truck, like as if they're game hunters on their way out to go after their game. And eventually they end up in a scuffle with him where he's shot and killed, right? And Ahmaud Arbery's story happened, I think it was February of 2020. So it was in the middle of the pandemic, the first wave of the pandemic, right, was really happening at that time. And the prosecutors really opted not to prosecute the father and son and their friend who had pursued Arbery. Why, in the end, then, are the McMichaels, Travis and McMichael and his father in prison right now? Why is Roddy Bryan in prison, the third of them? Because of the campaign that was initiated by social media among people in Georgia and outside of Georgia, finally, to see that those men were brought to justice. Why did that happen? Because we have social media. So the first story about George Floyd happens because of the cell phone we have in our pocket. The second happens because of social media that we have available to us. That we go on also tell the story of Kenosha, video journalists who brought us that story, as well as Charlottesville. So each story has its own integrity as a contemporary story, but it also has an historical resonance. And in the case of the Arbery story, the historical resonance is that he was pursued according to an 1863 law for citizens' arrest. Why did they establish a law in 1863 for citizens' arrest? What's the thing that happens in January of 1863 in this country? The Emancipation Proclamation. What was the law? The law was to catch fugitive slaves. And so that law, middle of the Civil War, gets application more than 150 years later into the chasing down and the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. So you see that each story then, for in terms of telling these stories, there's the modern story, there's the backstory. There's the modern story, there's the backstory. And that's how we organized the book.
Fantastic, I love it. So narrative is the key word for me regarding seen and unseen. How we shape our stories, how the South kind of shaped their story in terms of, you know, we were fighting for a just cause. We may not have won, but it was a just cause, states' rights, that we were fighting for. How can we tell the story of contemporary miscarriages of justice? So, like you were mentioning, Ahmaud Arbery, Charlottesville, when these things can be manipulated by social media. My follow-up question to that is, with the introduction of social media, as you were inferring, everybody has the access to cell phones and, you know, Twitter. And so how are we going to be able to distinguish the truth from what people can craft on their videos and their tweets, how they're able to tell their stories according to how they view them, according to how they see them?
So That's a very good question, Catherine, and it's one that I hope everyone in the audience will pick up on for its importance. It's sort of the question of our time in many ways, right? We now can see things that we couldn't see before. How do we know that they're true? How should we respond to them? And I think we mistakenly believe that raw video tells the entire story. Instead, I would observe that we need curators. We need people who share our values, people who honestly approach what it is that's been seen on the video, and tell us what's happening. In the book, we use the image of a Middle Eastern souk. A souk is like a market. It's a free market of in the Middle East, where you go and you just barter for your goods. In many ways, the modern media landscape is like a souk. It is all this raw information that's out there. And inevitably what happens is groups of people begin to form. You can see this in Black Twitter, for instance, right?
Yeah.
What is Black Twitter? Well, it's really just places where black people or people with interest in justice for black people can gather and find like-minded people who share their values. And so understanding what's happening in these videos requires that the rest of us, that all of us, speak to what the truths are that are there. In the book, Seen and Unseen, what we do, and that I want to come back at some point to tell you why it's called Seen and Unseen, but in the book, we look at the story of Kenosha. Now, and I'll remind everybody what Kenosha was. Kenosha was a violence that happened on the, I shouldn't say violence, it was first just protests happening on the streets of Kenosha over the shooting of a black man.
Jacob, right? Blake.
Yeah, Jacob Blake. And what happens is a group of self-styled militiamen move in to protect the private property in Kenosha. Uninvited, by the way, they come with arms, and they're on the notion that they're there to protect the property of the streets of Kenosha. Not that it was being threatened, by the way, but merely if it was threatened. And you have to consider, of course, the provocative nature of that act by itself. 17-year-old boy from Illinois, actually, comes into Kenosha to join up with the militiamen in order to be able to protect the private property, as he says. He proceeds to engage in there's a scuffle, there are multiple scuffles around the protesters, and he proceeds to kill two white men, actually, who were among those protesting the shooting of Jacob Blake. Now, everywhere throughout this episode, there are cameras. Cameras often manned by what we call sort of gonzo journalists, videographers who have taken it upon themselves to shoot the video, the raw video of an episode happening in front. They go, they're like storm chasers. They go towards episodes of potential violence and record it as video. And you can go on YouTube and you can watch this. You can watch 3 hours, a whole laying out of what happened in Kenosha on that night, and see the entire episode in film. Now, that video has then been taken and edited and used by people who see the injustice that happened on the streets. And by the way, Rittenhouse was cleared of all charges finally. And there's those on the other side who take the same video and edit it and produce it in order to see Rittenhouse and the other militiamen as heroes, right? So the question then becomes, who do we listen to? How do we deal with this raw video? Which curators do we respond to, right? And so we're once again back to the notion of values. Do we believe in racial justice? Do we believe that this nation has a history of racial violence against black people? Do we believe that black people have been deprived of their God-given rights here in this nation? Do we understand that there's a systemic level of racism in this country? If we believe those things, we see these stories one way. If we believe other things, we'll see the stories a different way. But it's the ideas that we should engage each other. It's the ideas that we need to bring to the forefront. We need to have a public conversation about these things to understand, as James Baldwin said, to face what we have done, not because it's white people's faces need to be smeared in, and not because we need to teach white children that they're bad, because this is the history of of our experience. We need to come to terms with it. It's what has been done in our name for centuries. Let's face it. I mean, Baldwin said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing that can be changed until it is faced. And so the notion of seen and unseen, which is a phrase out of Baldwin, is very particular to our story, the way we tell it here. We need to confront and face what we've done.
So let's just talk a little bit about the title. You said it was taken from a book from Evidence of Things Seen?
Yeah, it's taken from a book that as Mark often says, it's a book that both he and I have read, and it's usually considered to be one of the lesser Baldwin books, frankly.
There's no such thing, but
yeah,
go
but,
on.
Yeah, but I actually consider it to be a terrific book. It was actually the last book Baldwin wrote. Those of you who are around my age, you'll remember that in the early 1980s, there was a rash of killing of children in Atlanta, Georgia. And Baldwin wrote a book about it called Evidence of Things Not Seen. But he also, he is always fascinated by not only what we see, but what we don't see. And the book has multiple meanings, has multiple meanings. One of them is that through social media, through the cell phone, through the tools we have now, many people who have not been seen in American history are being seen for the first time, right? But it also has another meaning, which is what we see is only the first representation of the truth. We need to see behind to see what we don't see, to understand, for instance, as I referred to before, that these experiences don't happen in a vacuum. There is a rich history that preceded them, that preceded us, that precedes our birth as human beings. There's a history that we need to confront and understand. We're born into a society. We join society from the crib. And as we do, we join it with all its warts and tumors and all the things that were terrible in the past, but all the things that were glorious in the past too. We need to embrace the totality of the experience, not whitewash it.
I love that. So I just want to jump around a little bit. Now, you were kind of touching on this, but echo chambers, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're online. You tend to like things that people like you like. You tend to like tweets people like you tweet, right? You tend to friend these people. You tend to interact with just these people, right? And it becomes like this echo chamber. So it's your opinions being fed back to you by like-minded people. The problem with that is that you're not seeking influences and opinions outside of that influence. So then you just, if you're white nationalist, like, yeah, so, you know, black people suck, Jewish people suck, everybody who's not us sucks. I agree, you know what I mean? When it comes to African Americans, it's like, like, here we go again. You know, the unfortunate tragedy that happened in Buffalo, New York, okay? And we all see it coming, but it's we've become desensitized to it. Now, my question for you is, when it comes to echo chambers, seen and unseen does an excellent job of displaying the dangers of narrowing one's viewpoint. So there's that constant threat in social media. There's also a form of this in the past with newspapers. So, I mean, you know, we didn't have Twitter like back in the day, but, you know, African-Americans, we had the New Amsterdam, we had the Chicago Defender. But my problem or the question is, when it comes to echo chambers, how are we going to be able to get out of that in terms of social media and be able to find legitimate points of view, not hate-filled points of view, just legitimate points of view that are outside of our own view that are going to allow us to see the world in a different way, perhaps make it even a little bit better?
So you all know that Elon Musk is seeking to buy Twitter, right? I mean, the sale hasn't gone through. There's been some wrinkles recently, apparently, but the big question that we've been asked many places we've gone, and I think that's been part of the public conversation over the past couple of weeks has been, what difference will Elon Musk make if he is the new owner of Twitter? And one of all the rumblings we've heard from Musk are that he wants to restore, he says, a spirit of freedom of speech on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And he will restore former President Donald Trump's access to Twitter. Now, Twitter is not a public entity, so when he talks about freedom of speech, it's important to understand that the First Amendment doesn't protect, doesn't mean that Twitter can't regulate speech. It's a private entity. The First Amendment bans the state from regulating speech, except for a certain number of exceptions. But it's important to understand what the whole concept of freedom of speech is, as it was derived or as it was expressed by the founders back in the 18th century, and how it was reinvigorated in the early part of the 20th century around the time of the First World War. And the notion was this, that speech, when speech is free, it leads to better outcomes. When I can speak freely and not hide what I truly feel, and you can do the same thing, we can bring to our conversation something where I add to what you tell me and you add to what I tell you, and eventually we allow it a better result. It's a communitarian principle that says that when we talk, when we can do the kinds of things that we can do in the United States and most of the Western world, we will have better outcomes than we do in societies that are closed, right?
Absolutely.
So, but the question then comes, when do we feel that speech is properly regulated? And the notion is that when speech stops being communicative, when it stops having a communicative value, when it becomes more like a conduct or a physical act, when it becomes like an assault, then it loses its communication, its communicative value, and it then does not contribute to this notion of speech improving us, right? So when Elon Musk says that he wants to free up Twitter and not regulate it, not try to prevent the kinds of destructive speech that even President Donald Trump was making on Twitter, what he is doing is not encouraging the values of speech. He's actually discouraging them, because we end up having assault. That when speech is anti-Semitism, racism, fighting words, as the Constitution actually refers to them, the words that are not protected because they initiate violence, right? It's the closeness of the speech to a violent act that is considered to be when it enters into a criminal territory, right? So the idea is that speech that is communicative, that's what we should be valuing. That's what social media should look to have. We should look to create a conversation on social media that is free of these assaultive expressions of speech, that instead seeks to communicate something that where one idea adds to another idea in the notion of a very robust conversation. Then I think social media, in fact, was the value that social media upheld. If Elon Musk were to buy Twitter and then say, this is what I want to see, this is the model that I want to see for social media, if other social media leaders were to do that, then I think we would start to see an elevation of the speech. It's worth a try. It's worth us asking that selves of ourselves as a community.
Elon didn't give me no money, so next question was, in this push and pull of the past and the future, it seems that people are rediscovering civil rights legends, right? So Septima Clark and Frederick Douglass and Bayard Rustin and our boy James Baldwin, right? So my question is, due to the, you even described him, the book describes James Baldwin as kind of like a 21st century influencer, right? We all know how James Baldwin can take a turn of phrase and say something extremely profound about America and what it stood for, what it's supposed to stand for. So my question is, a lot of people seem to take James Baldwin or Malcolm X or these different civil rights leaders like Ida B. Wells for their own in terms of, let me retweet this really profound quote from James Baldwin and, act like I made it up. Or let me use this gif of James Baldwin, or let me use this gif of Malcolm X. I mean, it's spreading that kind of influence, or people are learning about them, but to what detriment?
I don't actually see I think there's a risk of us not really knowing what Baldwin truly said originally, right? But on the other hand, this may be one of the truly great things about social media. If, as we mentioned in the book, if Baldwin says not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced, and that expression is put out there by somebody as a tweet, and then somebody else responds and makes a real world makes a reference to a real world experience where they confronted this very question, and then they add to that notion, and then someone else comes into the conversation and adds something different. They start to pull apart the quote. They start to ask something about this phrase versus that phrase. Then you actually have a conversation going in the way that I mentioned it before. It is communicative. It actually, one idea is adding to another idea. We point out in the book that Baldwin does get sort of twisted and turned. He gets pulled like taffy, you know, on social media. But I actually think Baldwin would have loved that idea. It's people playing with language, with ideas, trying to find something new out of old materials, like taking old raw material from a building and building a completely new building, you know. And I think he would have enjoyed that. When we can do that, I think that social media has a tremendous benefit.
But see, I think my issue is people doing it with kind of a wannabe woke effect. So you're not doing it because you think he's saying something profound, or you think that it's something that you can use to make yourself a better person. I think my fear is it nullifying somehow his words, or you know, us being somehow a little bit numb to it, whereas, you know, it would just be like, this is like profound and this is what we need to do. And like you said, that inner change, like, I'm afraid of that not happening because of people like just like overusing and using again.
Yeah, we can certainly. I mean, look, I think that we all need, you know, every time there's a new technology in human history, it's taken a long time for people to understand the vocabulary of that technology, right? At first, think of you probably all know the story of the War of the Worlds radio broadcast, yes, you know, when people listening to what was a fictional story on the radio thought it was real and went out and thought the Martians were invading and end up getting in their cars in New Jersey to drive off. At first, we didn't know what television was. We certainly didn't know what the internet was. Even the telegraph had its period. We needed to understand the vocabulary of the technology in order to be able to both use it and understand it and understand what it's doing to us, right? So I think we're still in that period with social media. We've seen the benefits, we've seen the drawbacks, we're trying to adjust to it. Those who might use the medium, as you said, to sort of as a self-inflating kind of expression, well, that may fall on the wayside. Let me just say this, that, I mean, I teach the First Amendment, I've taught it at Temple, I've taught it at Mount Holyoke College, other places. I'm a big constitutionalist, I believe in it. But one of the things I say when I first greet students about this question, I say, what is freedom of speech? And they say, well, it means you can say anything you want to say. And I say, well, that's sort of true, but not entirely true. You know, there's things you can't say. You can't produce as expression. You know, you can't have fighting words, as we referred to before. You also can't create, child pornography is not protected by the First Amendment. There are certain things that are not protected. But what else is it? And they look kind of, well, what do you mean? What else could there be? And I said, well, listen, if you say, well, you can say whatever you want to say, is saying something its own value? Well, not if there's nobody there to hear, right? So the point is that there's a responsibility to hear attached to the freedom of speech. And there's a third element. The third element is you have to be willing to be changed by what you hear. You have to be willing to be changed by what you hear. Otherwise, the freedom of speech has no value, no societal value, right? It means that I am shouting, you are shouting, and there's this immovable barrier between us. But if I say something constructive, and you acknowledge that is constructive, and it changes what you think about something, now you say something back to me, and it changes what I... Now we have the communitarian value being played out in conversation. All communications media need to have some place of getting to that idea. And I do think that as we mature in the world of social media, we have the opportunity to arrive at that place. So your example of someone who misuses the medium, and of course any medium is going to be misused, probably even more than it's constructively used, just emphasizes exactly where we need to be rather than where we are.
Wonderful. So I have another question. Mm-hmm. So one of my questions was, I remember at the end of one of the chapters, I can't remember specifically, you and Mark were speaking about the advantages of having, social media, technology, and what if it was available to all of us in terms of like the past. So for instance, what if we had Twitter, and what if we had like Facebook Live when the Tulsa, Oklahoma race massacre happened, or the 1919 Chicago riots, or when Malcolm X was assassinated, or Martin Luther King Jr., or all of these people. Like, if we had the technology, do you think that it would have made the world somehow? And I know this is super hypothetical, and you know, you don't have, a huge helmet, and you can't tell me what would have happened, but just hypothetically speaking, do you think it would have made any kind of difference in terms of the racial issues, the deep racial issues that divides America, if we could have had a button and said, hey, look, this is what really happened. This isn't made up. You know what I mean? This isn't curated. This is what happened. Would there have been any kind of difference? Would we be 15 steps forward in terms of our relationship, or 15 steps back?
Of course, it's a tantalizing question, right? But not one that can really be answered. I mean, a few things to point out about this. One is that, the telegraph was the medium of the 19th century. Well, there were two great technological advancements in the 19th century, the locomotive and the telegraph. Both of them conquered distance, right? When Abraham Lincoln is composing the Emancipation Proclamation, he's sitting in the telegraph office of the War Department. Why? Because he loved the technology. And he's sitting there. He just used it as a place to sit while he's working with all the telegraph operators around me. Those of you who've seen the movie Lincoln will remember there's actually scenes of him doing this. And he was writing the Emancipation Proclamation, sticking it in a drawer. Nobody knew what he was working on, but he put it in the drawer. But he was fascinated with the telegraph, right? So you think what would happen if the telegraph instead of the telegraph? What would happen if there was photography? I'll tell you another interesting story from the Civil War. When the Civil War happens, photography is really in its portraiture period. It's like essentially people thought of the camera as a different form of painting, like quick painting, and you take portraits of people. Why did they think that way? Because they hadn't really ever explored the idea of photography being a journalism tool. They didn't have that opportunity, because to sit for a photograph, you had to hold still because the film speeds were so slow, first 10, 15 minutes sometimes. Alexander Gardner is working for Matthew Brady, the great portrait photographer of the 19th century, who took pictures of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, by the way, the most photographed man of the 19th century, the single most photographed man of the 19th century. Alexander Gardner, after the Battle of Antietam, the bloodiest day in American history, decides that rather than taking portraits that day, he's going to go up the next day to Maryland and go take photographs of the dead lying on the battlefield in Antietam. Those pictures, which showed the cost of war, were then shown in a gallery in New York City a few weeks later, and the line was around the block to go in and see them. People didn't know what war was, because war to them had been portrayed in painting as a heroic thing, only a heroic thing. They saw in the photographs something they had never seen before. So take modern technologies, all of them, and you would take them back to these various points in history, not only American history, but world history, you'd see a very different outcome, if only because people could see things that they weren't able to see. But that's what our moment is about, right? We're seeing things that we didn't see before. Nobody believes when Walter Scott is shot in the back in South Carolina, and the policeman later on puts the taser next to him and says, I was fighting over a taser with him. Nobody who had seen that film can say, look at that and think that was an isolated incident. You see that, you realize that you're seeing the barrier pulled back on what has been the black experience for decades, right? It's just that now we have the capability to show it. So technologies have tremendous benefit for understanding something. I'll say one other story. Martin Luther King, one of the greatest organizers in the history of American race relations. If Martin Luther King had Twitter, what kind of a march on Washington would we have had? 10 times the number of people would have been there. If he could react immediately to what was happening in Birmingham, those three girls shot, think of what the response would have been. Not any of us who have Twitter following can wake up and tweet about something that's happened not only the night before, but 5 minutes before. Martin Luther King could have done that if he had that tool of Twitter. So you say, yes, of course it would have changed things. But also, history is history. It doesn't show its alternatives. It doesn't tell us what would have happened. It only tells us what did happen, right?
Right. I believe we can go ahead and get this Q&A going.
Folks, if you have a question, I'm going to ask you to step up to the microphone here so that everyone can hear you. Come on up.
So you talked a lot about social media and videos and helping to awaken the national conscious in a positive way, right? But I was thinking about the findings from the Mueller report when it kind of showed Russians interfering with elections, creating these fake social media accounts, even in some cases having kind of I don't want to say civil rights organizations, but organizations that didn't exist. In other words, the ability to manipulate, the technology exists to manipulate social media, manipulate videos with like deep fakes.
Yeah.
And we've seen the power, obviously, with seeing that video of George Floyd. It can also be used in a different way. How do journalists and writers, how do they combat that? You know, how do they, are they kind of like watchdogs now, or how does that work?
You know, that's a very, very good question, of course. And those of you who have seen any of the deep fakes, most famous one, of course, is the one that Jordan Peele created with Barack Obama, right? To show exactly what is possible. And one of the darker consequences of that would be that we stop believing anything, right? We stop believing the next George Floyd video. We say it's faked, right? And there'll be plenty of people who will see it in their interest to convince us that it's fake. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know. I think that, I think we need to demand that the journalism that we use, the journalism that we seek to follow, to tell us the truth. There are an increasing number of organizations. One of them is called NewsGuard, that my son actually works for, but it's started by a guy named Steve Brill, that is attempting to news websites according to the degree of truthfulness that they have devoted themselves to, which will encourage advertisers not to advertise on places that are trafficking in disinformation. I think we have to resist the tendency to follow conspiracy theories, demand of our news organizations that they give us cold hard facts, legitimate, verifiable information, that they show us how they verify it, that they're transparent. It is as if we have, and people have referred to the Wild West of the social media world, and just like the Wild West, we need to impose some level of law and order on it. And I don't mean law and order I mean law and order in terms of understanding what is legitimate and what is not, and demanding of those who are feeding us information that they feed us information that has been verified, and that they approach it with a sincerity, that their mission is to inform, not to sway, but to inform. I hope that answers your question. I feel a little, I'm worried about it myself. I think we're actually right in that narrow place where videos are still very believable. But in just a few years, we may feel that there's so many deep fakes out there and so much manipulation video that our response may be to throw our hands up and say, we can't believe anything. The one thing I think we have to fight against is cynicism, you know, the cynical approach that says, well, it doesn't really matter. It does matter. If we care about our society, it matters, right? Another question.
Yes, I had the opportunity to volunteer at George Floyd Square with conservationists to preserve some of the artifacts and things of that nature. I also worked in Hennepin County as a case manager working with the homeless population. While volunteering on 38th and Chicago Avenue, I noticed that there was an unseen dynamic right there on that corner, where there was a dynamic of the young men who were somewhat angry because they felt that there had been so many people killed on that same corner and nobody gave a damn, you know? So I guess my question becomes, what do you believe that's peculiar about the state of Minnesota, where there's so much political and social upheaval, you know? Because, you know, you have the case of Philando Castile, you have the case of Dante Wright, and you also, you know, have George Floyd, and you have many others that are unseen. So what can you speak about in regards to, you know, what's going on in that particular area of the country?
Thank you for the question. Yeah, I don't actually believe there is anything peculiar going on in Minnesota. I'm not one who's reported on the political scene in Minnesota or has studied deeply the nature of policing in Minnesota. I can't say that I have. But I think one of the things that we point out in the book, and I think is true generally, is that these acts are happening almost any and everywhere. The reason that these resonate so deeply is because we have the material through which to see them, right? See them happening. They could coincidentally be in Minnesota, or they could be in South Carolina. They could be in Texas, or they could be in Grand Rapids, Michigan. They could be in Buffalo, as we saw yesterday, live streamed. That tells me that there is a systemic issue here. That's what it really tells me. And I don't think pointing the finger at Minnesota, although there are, you know, it was ample information, you know, to understand the society of Minnesota and its own racial characteristics and its response to racism in that state, I think is a worthy project. But I don't think that's at the heart of what we're trying to get at with this book. I think the overall point of this book is that we are seeing things through these tools that are going on everywhere. We're seeing the things that we can see, but there's the things that we don't see that are also happening. And just because they were caught on film doesn't mean that's an isolated incident. That's the big difference between now and Rodney King, because the response to Rodney King over time, and this is always an issue with video, the video happens, there's shocks, it draws a traumatic reaction, and then people wish it away in one way or another. And with Rodney King, the wishing away was that, oh, it's an outlier. There's a few bad apples. There's people in the police force that are not, you know, good character. But, you know, the rest of them are all fine. I think instead what we detect is, and what the past 30 years have shown, is that there's a systemic issue. There are black cops and Asian cops, and as well as white cops, who are practicing the same level of violence that you saw in some of these videos. It's the fact that the number of videos, and we know, sadly, that, you know, Buffalo will be followed by something else.
Can I just piggyback off of you? I think when it comes to, at least for us, for African Americans, social media became a really great equalizer in terms of showing America at large, white, black, brown, what was really happening. Until then, it was literally like ghost stories we were telling to one another. It was like, did you hear about? Do you know about? Like, he got beat, but, you know, the police aren't doing anything. Nobody said anything. The alderman isn't doing anything. It's literally almost like, until then, it was like a ghost story that you would hear.
Yeah, let me add one other thing to that. That's a very good point, Catherine. So we didn't talk about The Birth of a Nation, really.
No.
The Birth of a Nation is, as some of you will remember, I'm sure you've read about it, if not seen it, was this retelling of the story of the Civil War, essentially, and in order to emphasize what is often known as the lost cause of history, which is that the myth of the lost cause is how it's usually referenced, which is that the South didn't fight to save slavery, the South fought for states' rights, and that it fought, it was defeated only because there were greater numbers coming from the North, and because the North was the capitalist exploiter of the South and its cotton fields and its agriculture. The retelling of the story of the Civil War in Birth of a Nation is the story of two families, one a northern family, one a southern family, both white, who get separated by the fact that black people have been brought to these shores, and that black people have ruined the experience for white people, essentially. And that white people turned on this, and the North turned on the South, was a kind of perversion of the American idea. And that the two families in the story of the Birth of a Nation eventually marry together, the Northern family and the Southern family, as a way of showing that, oh no, it was not the divide between us, it was the bad Negro who got in our way, right? In the process, the movie reinforces a growing sense, particularly in the South, that was helping to reinforce Jim Crow laws, that the black population was lazy, corrupt, dirty, and that they should be denied even the limited power that had been given them during the time of Reconstruction. Terrible story to be telling, right? Monroe Trotter, W.B. Du Bois, the black leaders of the time, they wanted to create a movie that would be a counter voice to what was there, but they didn't have the resources to do it. This was a power dynamic, right? The Birth of a Nation, which was a brilliant piece of movie making, by the way, compelling as a piece of movie making. In fact, the first movie ever shown at the White House. The first substantial representation of the art of filmmaking. But the counter story was a ghost story, as you referenced it, because there was no money to support it. The power dynamic had basically erased that. Same thing happens a few years later with the making of the Gone with the Wind, the story of this sentimental story of the Southern plantation. Hattie McDaniel plays the mammy, the black maid.
Yeah.
Black nanny, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and she was actually like, well, you know, like, why did you like want to play a maid? And she was legit like, look, I'd rather play a maid and get paid for it than be a maid. Mm-hmm. That's what it was.
But when it came to giving the Oscar for the movie, she had to sit in the back.
All the way in the back.
Amazing. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, everybody. I appreciate it. We appreciate it so much. Y'all have a fantastic evening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, author Jabari Asim discusses his novel Yonder with journalist Evan F. Moore, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.